Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the May 22nd, 2013 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The administration of George W. Bush used the attack on 9/11 as an excuse to launch an unparalleled attack on American civil liberties. Within days, he had introduced the Patriot Act, the greatest attack on the Bill of Rights since the loyalty oaths and witch hunts of the early years of the Cold War, and his quick passage by both houses of Congress without even the pretense of a debate was an ominous warning of what lay ahead. In his campaign for the White House in 2008, then-Senator Barack Obama, along with a commitment to greater government transparency, promised to revisit the Patriot Act, but he wasn't specific about what he was going to do when he arrived. It turned out to be nothing. When the expiring provisions of the Act came up for reauthorization in late 2009, despite months of congressional debate, Obama signed it without demanding a single change. On May 26th of 2011, he reauthorized for another 4 years, that's until June 2015, another 4 years of the most controversial of the Act's surveillance provisions. While the bulk of the Patriot Act is not subject to periodic review, there are certain measures that Congress must periodically reauthorize or else they expire. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Vermont Democrat Senator Patrick Leahy and Senator Rand Paul, the Libertarian Republican from Kentucky, had sponsored an amendment that would have restricted the government's ability to intrude into our private lives, but it never was brought to a full vote. Gene McNeil, senior policy analyst of the Homeland Security at the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, which had supported the Act since its implementation, has written that, quote, President Obama probably did revisit the Patriot Act when he became president and realized that it was extremely helpful to investigators and already contained the needed oversight to ensure that it was used in a way that was consistent with the law and U.S. Constitution, end quote. That's not an opinion shared by many constitutional scholars, particularly after the most recent event, the chilling revelation that in search of members of his administration who may have leaked certain controversial stories to the media, Obama's Justice Department had subpoenaed 2 months of telephone records of 20 Associated Press journalists without having notified them in advance, depriving them of the opportunity to challenge the subpoenas in court. Despite the controversy over that, the Obama administration then announced it's going after Jack Rosen of Fox News as punishment for his efforts to get the administration's latest positions on North Korea from a State Department contractor. That's what we're going to be talking about later today, about 20 minutes past the hour, when I speak with Kevin Gostola of the muckraking website firedoglake.com, whose latest article on the website yesterday posed the problem when the Justice Department pursues reporters as spies. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's take a look at some of the things that have been happening since my last visit with you. First, there was a conviction of former Guatemalan dictator Efrain Rios Montt for the crime of genocide in a courtroom of the country that he ruled with a bloody iron fist in the 80s, which on Monday was overturned by the country's Supreme Court. As Associated Press reported, Guatemala's top court has thrown another curve into the case of Montt, overturning his conviction and ordering that the trial be taken back to the middle of the proceedings. That ruling late Monday, said the AP, threw into disarray a process that had been hailed as historic for delivering the first guilty verdict for genocide against a former Latin American leader. The headline in the New York Times article that had reported on the initial conviction read, quote, "Trial on Guatemalan Civil War carnage leaves out U.S. role." True, there was a long and ugly history of United States support for Guatemala's military, which began with a coup engineered by the CIA for the benefit of United Fruit, now Chiquita Brands, in 1954. They went unacknowledged during the genocide trial. During a month of testimony before the three-judge panel that found General Rios Montt guilty, wrote the Times' Elizabeth Malkin, the prosecution never raised the issue of American military backing in the Army's war against leftist guerrillas. The 86-year-old former dictator barely mentioned the United States when he argued in his own defense that he had no operational command over the troops that massacred and terrorized the Maya population during his rule in 1982 and 83. What Malkin did not mention, And what the mainstream press ignored was that the predominant role in arming the Guatemalan military following President Carter's cutoff of U.S. military aid in 1977 was performed by Israel, which on its own supplied counterinsurgency training to the Guatemalan army and 98% of its weaponry, including its uniforms, until the second year of Ronald Reagan's presidency, in which he let Elliot Abrams determine Washington's friends in Latin America. To illustrate the point, the Army's weapon of choice to kill the peasants of the Guatemalan highlands was the Israeli-made Galil rifle, and Galil soon became the popular word for rifle in Guatemala. You didn't hear about any of that in the U.S. at the time because the leading solidarity group for the people of Guatemala, the Guatemalan News and Information Bureau, was led, unfortunately, by activists who were also supporters of Israel, as were many of those working on behalf of Nicaragua and El Salvador, where Israeli arms were also used against the people. Malka did mention Israel, but only as one among other countries that had provided military assistance, like Taiwan, Argentina, and Chile, whose contribution was relatively insignificant. Back in the early 80s, there was a film made of the slaughter in Guatemala entitled The Hidden Holocaust, and I attended a showing of it at the College of Marin. Even though one could clearly see that the Guatemalan soldiers were wearing Israeli army uniforms and carrying the Israeli-made rifles, there was no mention of Israel in the film, in the book that accompanied it, or by the speaker who presented it. When I called this to the attention of the speaker from the Guatemalan News and Information Bureau, she did admit Israel's role but did not explain why it had been left out. Had I not spoken up, it would not have been mentioned. Afterward, two Guatemalan women came up to me and both reached out to grab my hand while profusely thanking me. "You were the first and only person to bring that up," they told me, expressing their bewilderment that Israel could be involved in such crimes and its role not be mentioned or the country judged. Before we leave Guatemala, I should mention that the remarkable journalist Alan Nairn, who is covering the trial and whom you may have heard on Democracy Now!, saying that, quote, "Now that Rios Montt has been convicted for the actions that the Guatemalan army took in the highlands, the next logical step is to look at those who were implementing the plan of Rios Montt. And the field commander on the ground at the time in the Exil region was Otto Perez Molina, who is now the president. When I met Perez Molina in 82, Nairn said, his troops were in the midst of a series of massacres, and the troops described how they would go into villages and execute civilians and torture civilians. So Perez Molina, said Nairn, is a definite logical target for criminal investigation. Although at the moment, as president, he still enjoys legal immunity, but that lapses as soon as he leaves an official position." End quote. Those are the words of Alan Nairn on Democracy Now! But Perez Molina has some important friends. By coincidence, in my email box yesterday, was a report from the American Jewish Committee, which is considered to be the State Department of the American Jewish Establishment, on its recent quote-unquote diplomatic mission to Guatemala last month. Quote, President Otto Perez Molina met with the AJC delegation, joined by leaders of Guatemala's Jewish community at the Presidential Palace, said the report. It was the president's second meeting with AJC leaders, who last visited Guatemala City in 2012, shortly after his inauguration. "Our hour-long meeting with President Perez Molina was most constructive," said Dina Siegel-Van, director of AJC's Latino and Latin American Institute, who led the delegation. "We are confident that President Perez Molina understands the importance of supporting face-to-face Israeli-Palestinian talks and not Palestinian end runs around the negotiating table." President Perez Molina assured the AJC delegation, as well as the Guatemalan Jewish leaders, the AJC's report went on, that his country's recent recognition of Palestine would not alter the historically warm ties with Israel. "Guatemala will not open an embassy in Ramallah or allow a Palestinian embassy in Guatemala City," he said. Further, President Perez Molina told the AJC delegation that he will visit Israel in December to convey his government's steadfast commitment to deepening bilateral ties, end quote. It was not mentioned in the American Jewish Committee report, but I could well imagine that he showed the visiting delegation a picture of himself back in the days when he was participating in the Guatemalan genocide wearing an Israeli army uniform. In Syria, the bloodletting continues with no end in sight, with some earlier independent supporters of outside intervention now having changed their minds in view of the realization that those leading the armed opposition against the government forces have as little interest in democratizing the country as does Bashar Assad. Should they succeed, Syria will no longer exist as a country, and what we see unfolding in Iraq with its ration of daily bombings will be duplicated with even more savagery. As it was with Iraq and is with Iran, those pushing the U.S. to intervene in Syria can be found invariably in one of the pro-Israel think tanks that dominate the Washington political scene and who also invariably will be seen and heard as the talking heads on Fox and NPR and everything in between. Dennis Ross, who once was described by Aaron David Miller, a fellow one-time White House peace process negotiator, as Israel's lawyer, is now back at the APAC-spawned Washington Institute for Near East Policy after leaving the Obama administration. 2 weeks ago, after Israel had attacked Damascus with deadly missiles, writing in the May 8th issue of the unabashedly pro-Israel New Republic, Ross called on President Obama to follow Israel's example. "Israel has once again demonstrated that when it sets a red line with its neighbors, it means it," wrote Ross, having declared that they will prevent qualitatively new arms from being transferred from Syria to Hezbollah, the Israelis, without openly admitting it, act to enforce the threshold, end quote. The fact that there was not a shred of evidence presented by Israel that such an arms transfer was taking place has been totally ignored by the U.S. media, as it was by Ross. He writes, "The Israelis are acting on their red line, and President Obama will have to act on his." As President Obama likes to say, he does not bluff. The real question for the administration is not whether we must respond to the crossing the red line. We must. "Are we going to have a one-off kind of action to show there's a price for the Syrian breach of our red line?" asked Ross. "Or are we going to use the Syrian game changer to change the game in Syria?" Eschewing the complications of enforcing a no-fly zone, Ross suggested, quote, "An option that would be more consistent with the Israeli model would be to make clear that we will target discrete Syrian forces or units that employ chemical weapons, or, more ambitiously, we could target those Syrian air bases that are used to attack cities and villages with conventional bombs," end quote. In other words, Dennis Ross is calling on the U.S. to start another Middle East war, irrespective of whether or not Syria has used chemical weapons or attacked the United States. Despite leaving the Obama White House, Ross reportedly has a phone on his Washington Institute for Near East Policy desk with a direct line to the president. And then there's Iran, where the same hawks are willing to shed the blood of America's youth and perhaps our immediate economic future for Israel. I've told you before about Senate Resolution 65, although non-binding, which calls for the U.S. to back up politically, economically, and most importantly, militarily, should it choose to attack Iran, claiming, of course, it was done in self-defense. In other words, we could go to war on Israel's choosing. Today, the Senate is scheduled to vote on it, and odds are that it will pass 100-0 by exclamation, by voice vote, without Harry Reid taking a roll call vote. To conclude on a positive note, the decision by the world's most famous physicist, Stephen Hawking, to boycott a major international conference in Israel may turn out to be the most important event that has yet occurred on the Palestinians' behalf since their country was taken over by the Israelis and they were ethnically cleansed 65 years ago this month. While there have been a number of famous celebrities who have decided not to perform in Israel for political reasons, Hawking's decision to acknowledge the request of Palestinian academics and not allow the Jewish state to use him raises the boycott movement to a new level. Even the Boston Globe, owned by the New York Times, had to acknowledge that in an editorial on May 11th. Quote, "When the esteemed physicist Stephen Hawking announced his decision to boycott Israel's presidential conference, a gathering of politicians, scholars, and other high-profile figures scheduled for June, the response was as predictable as the movement of the cosmos that inspired Hawking's career. The conference chair, Israel Maman, called the move, quote, outrageous and improper, end quote, while Omar Barghouti, the founder of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement that advocates protests against Israel's policies, declared, quote, Palestinians deeply appreciate Stephen Hawking's support. In fact, the editorial points out, the decision to withdraw from a conference is a reasonable way to express one's political views. Observers need not agree with Hawking's position in order to understand and even respect his choice. The movement that Hawking has signed on to aims to place pressure on Israel through peaceful means. In the context of Mideast conflict that has caused so much destruction and cost so many lives, nonviolence is something to be encouraged. That is equally true of attempts to inspire cooperation on the Palestinian side, end quote. Not an endorsement, to be sure, from the Boston Globe, but recognition of what may be the harbinger of a changed reality.